Jason with you, Horsley, with The Liminalist, the podcast between. Today I'll be discussing True Detective Season 2 with Heather Poirier of Notes on hplovecraft.blogspot.com. If you haven't seen all of Season 2 of True Detective, if you got put off by the incomprehensibility of the plot, or lost interest with the 5th and 6th episode slump, I encourage you to watch all of the shows before listening to this podcast or reading the accompanying article. It's well worth the time and the trouble, and much of what you're going to hear us talking about today won't make a great deal of sense if you're not familiar with the show. And lastly, just to thank my wife, whose birthday is coming up, wish her a happy birthday. Without her detective skills, I wouldn't have found Heather Poirier, and you wouldn't be listening to this podcast. That I contacted you, as you know, was around True Detective, the second season, and specifically I was getting very immersed in it, and then I became aware of how there was this quite a strong negative reaction to it, and what I saw as a misunderstanding or premature dismissal, and so that kind of fired up my interest more. I generally increases my interest in some cultural phenomenon when it seems like it's not being grokked. And so I was looking for somebody to talk to about it on podcast, and it was through my wife that we ended up at your blog, and I was immediately taken, not just with the little bit that you'd written about True Detective already, but specifically with this, I don't know if you call it thesis, this description that you're working on now about the artist investigator.
Right. That's for a conference paper that I'm going to present next week at Necronomicon in Providence, Rhode Island, because this year is the big anniversary of H.P. Lovecraft's birth. And so I'm very happy about that. But yeah, that one really focuses on season one. But like you, I think that season two was unfairly judged. Part of its problem, it kind of is like having a Nobel Prize winner for a big brother. You can never really live up to that standard. And I think True Detective 2 is unfairly judged by the content and just really the whole package of the first season. I think that if you can pull the curtains over the first season, I think the second season is just top rate. And I think I think there's the thing that is the real source of misunderstanding, and I didn't really get this until much later into the season. True Detective Season 1 is very much part of the detective fiction tradition. But Season 2 is part of the espionage fiction tradition, which has a different armature. It has a different set of metaphors that it uses. Some of them seem kind of like detective fiction, and it is, in fact, a subgenre of it, but it's very, very different in its own way. And this armature runs all the way through the second season, and it's not really apparent, and that's unfortunate. I think it's a deft move on Pizzolatto's part that he did not sort of lay it all out very specifically. But yeah, I think that's part of the way that it's misjudged. So yeah, we can talk about that and... talk about Greek tragedy and, the underworld as the bridging metaphor and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I definitely want to get into all that. I actually liked season two better than season one. I may be in a very small minority there, but I just found it, in the end, much more heartfelt. I felt that it got much more to the core of the characters and of a human tragedy that it was describing, whereas season one seemed to be more about intellectual existential explorations, and which is very compelling in itself. But season two actually left me in a kind of dazed state, which I very rarely experience from well, certainly TV shows, probably never, but even from movies that I consider works of art, there's only a very small handful that affect me at such a deep level. And I'm not sure how much of it was just the timing that things I was going through and it happened to intersect with that, and how much was really there in the work itself. That's always a kind of unknowable question. But one thing that did occur to me by the end, and even throughout the course of it, but by the end, to me it seemed like the whole plot and the storyline of the second season was really just a delivery device for these archetypal tragic meanings that the writer was conveying. And also that, maybe related, that the whole thing of detective, I mean, the title became kind of a misnomer, I thought, in season two. It wasn't really a detective show.
I agree. The whole thing about powerful forces moving through people's lives, and I read that draft that you sent me, and I quite agree with the things that you're pointing out in it. We start out that first episode, you know you're hip deep in Greek tragedy when you have a character named Antigonus whose father lives on top of the mountain, has long white hair, and wears clothes that look like long robes. I mean, there's no way around this. But what I think was really well done is that you don't just stay in Greek tragedy, you move towards the ideas behind it. The ideas of these powerful forces controlling the lives of people that never are held accountable. There's no way to reach them. They are implacable. They do what they want whenever they want. And nobody can do anything about that. And by the time we get to the end, we have the typical thing. All of the men are dead. The women are left behind to pick up everything and keep it going. But they're having, everybody is now in the underworld. Everybody is moving through the same space. And there's no escaping the underworld that everyone is in, whether it is the criminal underworld, the underworld of someone's psyche, the human trafficking corridors, whatever it is, everything is an underworld. There is no surface and there is no Olympus anymore, at least not that is accessible for normal people.
Well, it's kind of making me think of the subject of this podcast, ostensibly, is the whole idea of liminality and being the threshold between worlds. And I mean, you're talking about that everything is underworld, so then how would we recognize the underworld if there was nothing to contrast it with?
Well, I think that's part of the problem for the characters, isn't it? I mean, they, by the time the end of the first... Oh, and another Greek tragedy thing, the guy... whose body we find, he has wounds straight out of Greek tragedy. He has the eyes gouged out like Oedipus has, and he has the castration symbols, and it's just crazy. But by the time we get to the end of that first episode, we've got three people who are full blown, full bore into the death drive. All three of these guys have absolutely nothing to live for, and they come together, you know, trying to figure out why someone else died. One of the things that makes this season so interesting is in that first season, you know, you had Cole and Hart there who able to correctly interpret evidence. And in the second season, it is really difficult for these guys to correctly interpret evidence. I mean, they only are able to do it in a few places. And by the time we get to the end, they've got a little bit more information and they're able to sort of pull things together. And Ray Velcoro is the one who ultimately figures it all out. But they're not able to work together. And this is part, I think, of the effect of the underworld that they live in. They can't distinguish what is not underworld and what is underworld, because there's no way for them to escape it. Mm-hmm. There is no way for them to reach any other level of existence.
So in the sense, they can't even recognize that they're in the underworld.
Right. And even if they did, would it matter? I mean, they can't get out of it. You know, Annie is going to have to run for the rest of her life. I don't see how she can go back. You know, the Mexicans who killed Frank Simeon probably are not after her, but you never know. I mean, this guy apparently wants to make a name for himself, so, you know, she might come across his list at some point. Velcaro's dead. She can't go back to California, certainly, because there are people who are waiting to kill her. So, what, you know, what's she going to do? What point would there be in coming back? She's going to have to stay in the underworld for the rest of her life. So is her kid.
Yeah.
So is Jordan Simeon. I mean, nobody gets out. Nobody escapes.
Are you familiar with René Girard?
Only a little. I don't think I've ever done any direct reading.
Oh, it just came to mind because you mentioned Oedipus, and he uses the tale of Oedipus specifically to support his scapegoat model of society, that communities need a scapegoat to bind them together, and the essential thing about the scapegoat is that everyone agrees that he's guilty, but in fact the scapegoat never is guilty because he's a scapegoat.
Right, that's the sort of, that idea of the scapegoat, the community, and often it's a priest-type figure, a leader-type figure who sacrifices the scapegoat to redeem the community.
Yeah.
That's actually the structure of detective fiction. It is the detective, the criminal, in society.
Right.
But it's that same dynamic, that same tension, and that same, you know, thing powering the dynamic. But yeah, can you have this? Can you even scapegoat anybody? I mean, by the time we get to the end of the last episode, there are dead bodies everywhere. I mean, this is, you know, also Hamlet, you know, everybody is dead. Everybody's in there.
Yeah, and Velcoro was scapegoated by the system, by these powers that you're talking about, but he also sacrificed himself in order to protect Bezarides. So.
Right, and Woodrow was scapegoated, essentially, not because he was gay, but because he knew too much. But the two things ended up being tied together against him. And, you know, Annie Bezarides, I don't know, she was probably going to come to a violent end at some point because she just had too much. She had too much to reckon with. So the fact that she is on the run is probably the best possible outcome she could have hoped for.
She literally went south.
Yeah. Yep.
So you were mentioning, when you said before, the three guys with a death drive, you were meaning Bezarides is one of the three there.
Right. Yeah. I use the word guys as encompassing all humans.
Yeah, so we're talking about the cop leads, whereas Frank, the fourth lead, is the one guy who does have something to live for, at least at the beginning, or even to the end. Like, he's clinging to those diamonds to the very end, and that's what kills him.
Yeah, his idea of having a child, and then his idea of getting his fortune back. This whole idea that he needs something outside of himself to sort of justify what he was. And you know, it's interesting, I didn't even go into any of the class structures in any of this, but there's a fascinating study that you could do about how class structures are used, because at one point he says, you know, I've got all this money, I don't know what to do with it. Well, that's because you don't come from a background with money. If you come from a background where people had money, you know what to do with it.
Yeah.
And you know how to make it get larger. You know how to expand it. You know how to expand your own agency with it. And he has always expanded his agency through violence, not through money. I mean, or violence leading to money, which then turns around to more violence. You know, it's sort of its own Greek cycle. But he doesn't really know what to do, which is unfortunate. They very directly connect this with his death. I mean, there's, of all of the paths, his is the most carefully laid out, the most direct between his actions and his outcome.
Hmm.
He's not used. He's not somebody that you can use. I mean, the fact that these people got his money away from him by the time of the end, I'm thinking it's something just short of a miracle, because otherwise he is not somebody who would normally be tricked this way. But it's interesting that he got tricked trying to be legit, not trying to be a criminal. Had he been part of the full criminal underworld, probably wouldn't have happened. But he's in that, like you're saying, the liminality. He's in that nebulous area between the criminal world and the legit world. And by the way, transportation has always been involved in that sort of double society thing. But the fact that he is there and he's in unfamiliar territory, that's what makes it possible for them to take advantage of.
Right.
Yeah.
I definitely want to get to transportation, but just lingering on this a bit longer, it seems like it has to do with Frank's naivete in terms of the the powers, these implacable powers that he's trying to align himself with and level up to become one of, he doesn't realize that he's not of the bloodlines, he's not of the aristocracy, he's never actually going to be let into that club. And of course, that relates to his naivety, that he thinks that he's becoming legit. He doesn't really understand that the legitimate powers in the world are far more criminal than the criminal underworld is, in a sense, or far more ruthless and destructive.
True. And that's what's kind of sad, because what he is doing, and you know, part of Pizzolatto's project, I think, is this whole idea of the American dream, that if by hook or by crook you can sort of assemble some kind of reliable, steady income, multiple income streams or whatever, that will somehow gain you legitimacy. And that will, you know, you'll have the big house with a portrait of yourself in the living room and all of that good stuff. And it doesn't matter, you know, if it's a lot of selling us, it doesn't matter, because you won't get there anyway. You will not be let in. And because it got way more complex when you weren't looking and couldn't have known, and there's information you'll never have, there's access to power that you'll never have. You know, you really, you know, Frank Simeon really did need a couple of generations of kids with money behind them to get into those lines of power. He himself, as a first generation guy, was not going to be able to do it. So the whole thing about immigration is also really interesting. You know, as the first generation with all the money, not going to be pulled in. He'd have to have a couple of generations of kids who could prove that their skills and things, kind of like we see. Chisani was mayor, but it's his son, Tony, who was the real force behind what was going on and who is the real one behind the development of the rail line, because he's the one there when they're driving the spike in. So it's, you know, it's this multi-generational thing. And again, back to Great Tragedy, you know, Oedipus and Antigone and all of these stories about how tragedy passes through generations and just gets handed down and handed down.
Right, that's like the ancestral legacy. Yep. And the poisons that are being passed down. Yep. That actually there's a power in that plutonic kind of underworld power is in the poisons.
Yeah.
So, there's a lot of different threads. I've just had a brain fart.
One of the interesting things, I talked about espionage fiction, by about, I don't know, probably in the first episode, certainly by the second episode, I found myself realizing in just how many places Pizzolatto was just blowing up the conventions of the cop story. And this happens every once in a while in the first season, but it's almost like the entire purpose of the second season is to take all of these tropes and all of these conventions and just tear them apart.
Yeah.
You know, these three cops get brought together. They don't bond. Normally what happens is we are the brotherhood of police. We will work together. No, these guys have a terrible time trusting each other. They don't have the skills to do the kind of investigation that they need to do. There's all these scenes where you think it's going to go one way because that's the convention of cop fiction and police procedurals. Doesn't ever happen. Everything falls apart. I mean, even the sex scene between Annie and Ray. Yeah, she tries to seduce him when she's on the Molly. Understandable, you know, this happens all the time. It's one of the reasons you take Molly. Doesn't work. He's a good guy. He knows not to do it. And then they come back and they have the scene that is supposed to be, you know, in sort of conventional romantic terms. It should be this, you know, the sort of long gazing scene where they're, you know, lovers deep into each other's eyes, blah, blah, blah. Instead, they're each having a terrible internal struggle. And it's reflected on their faces. So nothing goes the way it's supposed to go. And that's because, again, you've got this armature of espionage fiction where you've got, you know, instead of the spy, the handler, and the counter spy, you've got the investigator, the supervisor, and the corrupt cop. And in most instances, the supervisor turned out to be corrupt, just like the other corrupt cop, like Burris, is like sort of the ultimate corrupt cop in this. In this one, and Holloway, the guy who Vilcaro met in the airport near the end, you know, everything gets blown apart and everything gets taken apart, and it's sort of interesting, you know, these little people's lives, so to speak, little people's lives, they get torn to pieces. Nothing in the insular class changes. Everything goes exactly as planned. It goes exactly as it was laid out. The guy gets elected attorney general, Tony Chisani owns the railroad, you know, all that stuff falls right into place.
Mm. So do you think that the, I'd say incomprehensibility, but the opacity of the plot, at least in the early episodes, was deliberate in terms of representing the reality of that, that really it's not something that we can understand or unpack, and that the characters can't either, and so the viewer is kind of supposed to be kept out of what's going on just by the complexity of it.
I think so. I think, you know, and it's interesting how I think it's really well balanced the way the Pizzolatto structured it. I think it is equally, you know, difficulty on the part of the cops to understand, and because they are being blocked by their superiors from understanding, and they're being set against one another. You know, they're all being fed information. Well, you need to watch out for this cop over here because blah, blah, blah. They're set against each other.
Yeah.
And on top of that, the people in power have taken steps to protect themselves from what's going on by having all these layers of corrupt cops and by, you know, destroying paper trails and doing whatever. I mean, the real sort of bizarre thing about this is that the reason Casper dies is because two people from his past decide they're going to take him down because of what he did to their parents. And the way that he's killed just is this kind, not really a random thing, but it was completely out of the plans,
right,
of the people in power, totally out of the plans. But for you know, their efforts and the efforts of their subordinates, things could really have fallen apart. And you don't know, they may fall apart yet again, because that stuff got passed on to a newspaper report. But we don't know if that ever happens.
Hmm. Did you also notice the kind of weird slump in the middle of the season
Yeah, I did. Yeah, and you know, it's really hard. It is interesting, like you were saying in your paper. It's interesting. You wonder, did the studio step in? It's possible. You know, Matthew McConaughey and what's his name?
Harrelson.
Yeah, Woody Harrelson. If I recall correctly, they're both executive producers of True Detective. So they may have stepped in. I mean, there's at any point, you know, somebody might have stepped in. But also, you know, it also became much more police procedural stuff. And the same thing happened in the first season of True Detective in a much more subtle way, when Cole and Hart get back together in the present day and they start working together again. The police procedural stuff really kicks in then, and we discover that Hart is, in fact, a really good cop. He's a really good investigator. He's good at finding the right kind of information and knowing where to look for information, which is not something we saw in him before. So there wasn't a slump in season one, but there was a place where the police procedural stuff kicked in, and we had that same thing happen.
Hmm.
I think the tone of the two seasons is just so different.
Yeah.
I agree with you when you talk about how richly textured this season was, absolutely. And as important as sound was in that first season, sound was so much more important in this second season. I mean, you got to hang on to every word of dialogue, and you just have to watch so much for the texture of detail in it. And I think people may not have realized that, may not have been prepared for it, may not have been willing to do it.
Hmm. Did you see The Counselor?
No, I did not. That's not something. What is that about?
That's a Cormac McCarthy script, and there's a lot of parallels with this second season because it's about transportation of diamonds. I mean, the plot circles around diamonds, and then it's essentially about a drug deal that just goes horribly wrong and everybody dies. But it ties in with Mexican cartels and snuff movies, and it's an existential script. It's and not necessarily Greek, but certainly archetypal. It really is like a kind of metaphorical parable for the underworld, being lost in the underworld, for being damned, but intersecting with social realities in terms of what's going on in America and Mexico and all the rest of it. So it's a very political, unusually political thing, but also more than unusually, I mean, unprecedentedly existential or profound exploration of the psyche, I would say. But it's also a real downer, which I'd say obviously is true of the second True Detective season. I mean, from the start, not counting that slump, which ironically for many viewers maybe was more enjoyable because it was more accessible and more familiar, but most of True Detective season two has this unremitting bleakness of just defeat, just that there isn't any way out, as you're describing. There isn't any way out of this trap that is built into the fabric of society and of the psyche in some way.
Yeah, I think that points back too to Greek tragedy and the heavy sense of irony, because you know the Greek tragedies were performed over and over and over again. It wasn't like they had this huge body of work to choose from. And so people would go in and watch them knowing what was going to happen. You go in going to Oedipus knowing what is going to happen in the end.
Yeah.
So there is a sense of that in this second season, that sense of futility and that sense of irony, you know, that, you know, we've done all these investigations over and over and over again, back to the time is a flat circle thing. You know, we do this over and over and over again, and does it ever really matter? Does it ever make any difference? Does it ever change the outcome of anything?
Well, I think that Pizzolatto did a great job of actually creating enough doubt that it might work out. And maybe that was part of what the slump was about, that for a while it seemed like it was just a more or less conventional TV show, a little edgier than usual. And so in the final episode, it seemed as though he was kind of fanning the tiny flame of hope that there might be some way out for these characters, even though if we've been paying attention, we know that there isn't, and if he's really going to be true to the narrative that he's created, then they're doomed. But of course, we don't want them to be doomed. We want so desperately for it to come out differently this time. I think he plays on that brilliantly.
I was so annoyed when he killed off Frank Simeon. I mean, I really was rooting for Frank.
Yeah.
Right. I knew that Ray Valcaro was going to die from the first episode. There's no way that guy is not going to die.
Right.
I think Annie probably could have died at some point. She basically has nothing to live for. But Frank, you know, he was always able to get out of every situation before.
Mm-hmm.
But that one last time, whoever sold him out, and it's interesting. I'm not really sure who sold him out. But that last, I figure it was probably those two Russian men.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the last deal just didn't go through. Really annoying.
Well, as I said, it was a the sum of his actions, and it was, of course, with all the characters, and that's the whole meaning of tragedy. But with Frank, it was most explicit. Well, actually, it was equally explicit with Ray, but Ray did something good. He did the right thing, and he died for it. And he when both times, actually, by saying goodbye to his son and by protecting Annie, that those two acts made his death inevitable. And so that was something heroic there. But Frank, I mean, he became as likable as Ray, and so we're rooting for him. But essentially, he is a criminal, not that Ray isn't. But I mean, he's been driven by the will to power, let's say, in a way that Ray wasn't. Ray just, had a real long run of bad luck and ended up the man that he had tried not to be. He ended up becoming that man, right? Whereas Frank was, he became the man he wanted to be, and that man was a criminal. And I think that was shown in the end, in a very subtle, very simple way, that he wouldn't let go of the diamonds. He probably would have lived if he'd actually been willing to give up his suit and the clothes make the man, right? If he'd been able to give up that exterior, then they may have let him live, and he would have managed to make it back. But he'd have been reduced to nothing. So it's like he couldn't. It was like the walk into the abyss. That last scene with Frank crossing the abyss, and that they say you can't. If you hold on to even the tiniest shred of who you think you are, then you can't make it across the abyss. So it's like the diamonds were that thing that he just couldn't let go of, that will to power.
Yeah, and it's interesting how all the scenery is always reversed too, right? He's both, he is the underworld figure, dies in broad daylight, it unremitting sunlight, baked surface. The whole idea, this idea of the will to power, it's interesting, all these different ideas of power floating around. For Frank, it's money. The combination of money and violence. For Velcaro, it's violence. For Annie, it is sort of like personal independence, being able to preserve her core sense of herself, the kind of psychological virginity. Woodrow, just keeping this whole gay thing under wraps, let's not address that, the power of concealment. I think a lot of people have the idea that some kind of power that they've defined for themselves is what's going to save them. And when, in fact, Pizzolatto is telling us nothing is going to save anybody. We don't know that Annie and the baby and Jordan are ever going to, do they survive 5 feet past where the camera stops?
Sorry, say that again.
So do we don't even know if Annie and the baby and Nails and Jordan survive. Do they get, taken out 5 feet beyond where the camera stops? We don't know.
Right.
They just go off, and they're in this big mass of humanity.
Yeah, well, going back to what you're talking about how the show, how the season undermines expectations or confounds expectations for the genre, I think it also, and maybe this is part of the trouble that it had, it also confounded expectations, as you pointed out at the beginning, for the fans of the first season. And part of that is to do with the revelations that were promised. I think because there was some disappointment in the first season also. I mean, I've been discussing this at this forum called Rigorous Intuition, which is a parapolitical forum for people who are interested in a conspiratorial view of things and social engineering and that kind of thing. And so there was some disappointment among that crowd with season one, because it seemed as it backed away from the kind of intricacy of the machinery of conspiracy around sexual abuse of children, etc., that Cole and Hart were getting close to uncovering. I mean, the characters, backed away, which I think is perfectly realistic, but there was the feeling that the show, the makers of the show, also backed away by kind of letting the viewer believe that really it was, just a lone crazy guy after all, even though there were plenty of indications that it wasn't. And then with the second season, it seemed as though it with the first couple of episodes, for me at least, it was promising something similar, that there was this undercurrent or this underworld of depravity, sexual depravity, that related to Annie's past, her father, the social engineering, the Esalen kind of spiritual things, and again the abuse of children. And so I, at least, and many others, I think, are expecting the show to end with this big reveal, or to lead to this big reveal. But in actual fact, it didn't. It went deeper and smaller and closer and into the characters themselves and their own personal tragedy and their own trauma. And that was actually much more powerful in the end, and much more realistic, of course, because these hidden agendas aren't revealed. They're not exposed by, you know, just three rogue cops. That's never going to happen.
Yeah, I agree. Season one, I used to live in South Louisiana. I lived there for 12 and a half years. And I can tell you, just personal experience, there's no way those figures ever would have been exposed to public scrutiny. That was simply not going to happen. The political structures have been in place for too long and go too far. And I think that's kind of what Pizzolatto was saying in the second season, too, because we do get a reveal. We know who has done what, and we know in both seasons, we know who the bad guys are, we know who the perpetrators are. And, you know, we've got photos of them, videotapes or whatever. We know that their identity is. The fact that they're not taken into court, I don't think either group could have been taken into court. I don't think they would have spent a day in court. I think Pizzolatto is trying to tell us this, that it is not possible, and it hasn't been possible for a very long time. I think that may be why he introduces these elements of group tragedy, too. This is how far back the notion of this kind of power structure in Western society has existed. And this is how far back this impulse goes. So don't be naive and think that you're going to get these guys in court one day. You'll get their lackeys in court. You'll get their corporations in court. That there are people in places that you are never, probably ever going to see unless they get their photo taken at a party with a bunch of prostitutes, or get a videotape, you know, of a girl being molested and murdered. That's the only time you're going to see their identities. Otherwise, it is absolutely not going to happen. So, yeah, I agree. I mean, you think the things that you guys are talking about, I understand the disappointment. But I gotta side with Pizzolatto. I think you can't really expect these guys to face any kind of consequences to their actions. There is too much at stake for too many layers of too many people to permit that to happen.
Well, and even just a less, maybe seemingly less ambitious goal of kind of deconstructing all of the agendas and all of the different streams of social engineering that have gone into these, creating these power structures over the decades and over the centuries, which he hints at in both seasons. Even that is kind of unrealistic, because it is so complex and so multi-layered.
I agree.
It seems. So it's almost as though the hints are, they're almost more satisfying than if he started to really reveal stuff, because of course then he would have to start inventing, because we don't really know. I mean, there is more. I don't know if you've been following what's been going on in Britain in the last couple of years since Jimmy Savile died.
Oh, that's been crazy. Oh, my God.
Yeah,
I've been following that. It's interesting. The structure keeps itself in place because it tosses just enough rewards to just enough people that they have a vested interest in retaining those rewards. It really is very much a Pavlovian system. And that's also part of the problem, is this behavior. They set themselves up as the protecting wall. They set themselves up as the interlopers between society and the criminals. And so you have society working against itself, which is unfortunate. But again, you know, you have to, much more so in the second season. You know, this is really the big thing that Pizzolatto wants to get across, is that it's not just the big people in power, it's their lackeys, it's their associates, it's the people that they've placed in positions who believe that they're going to get a larger piece of the pie than they don't realize just how expendable they are.
Can you say a bit more about that, about the interlopers and how that works, and also the Pavlov's dog thing? I didn't quite get that.
Because it's a conditioned response, because you know, and I think Woodrow might have been somebody that they were looking at doing this with. So you've got this poor guy who gets falsely accused by this actress who doesn't want to go back to jail because she's violating her parole conditions. And he can't disprove it, and she can't. Everything is going to swing in her favor because she's the one who has the money. So in order to get himself out of this, he just wants to get back on the bike. He is promised he can have his bike back if he does X, if he works with these people. And if he does right. this, and if he gets this information out, or if he picks up this information and brings it. And he sort of functions, he is the real sort of sacrificial lamb. I mean, he functions in this way all the way through. He is promised all these things. Things will get better if you do X. Things will get better if you do Y. He goes to, at the end, right before he's killed, he goes to meet Miguel, the guy that he slept with, thinking that he's going to be the one, he's going to make him erase the pictures and then everything's going to be okay, when in fact he goes in and he finds that the two paths of his past have now converged. And he's got to reckon with all this stuff down here. And he just doesn't understand. He keeps taking the rewards and never really looking, I think, adequately at the consequences of the taking of those rewards, never really thinking things through.
Right.
And because of that, you know, he is completely vulnerable. When he walks out of that place, he doesn't look around. He doesn't look to see Burris, who is right behind him with a gun. I mean, that's being a bad cop.
Right.
He really should have seen that, but he didn't. And it's I think it's because the way that his character was developed is to, you know, hold on to these little things that he's thrown and hope that there's going to be more. And if he complies, more will come. So that's the whole Pavlovian thing. If I do X, I'll get Y. If I do X, I'll get Y. And that's spread all the way through. You know, Burris is the same way. Velcaro almost got him with the shotgun in the Redwoods. But he didn't because he had buddies with him. You know, Burris tosses out, and I guess the big reward for Burris is probably the fact that he gets to go to these parties with hookers, because he is always in the background. He is probably not ever going to be a guy who is on top, but he is thrown his own portion of the rewards, and he keeps coming back, partly because he is so deeply entwined, but partly because he gets those rewards. You know, why does Tony Chisani have this Ukrainian wife? Well, because he can. You know, because she was a hooker he took in, because he liked. She doesn't really have a major part in it, but she has her rewards doled out to her. The daughter has her rewards doled out to her. Everybody is getting some little piece of something. The people who don't are the two kids who survived the jewelry store and who are the perpetrators of Casper's murder.
Right.
They don't get a piece of that pie. They're the ones who are free to take action.
It set the whole plot in motion, effectively.
Yeah.
Right. But they're on a revenge mission. I mean, they're orphaned. They've been.
Mm-hmm. Yep, back to Greek tragedy again. I mean, this is, you know.
In time, you find your way to release, and then it goes away again. What had been the strongest force against you becomes your only friend. You can't help but laugh, and I own your soul, a shadow unwanted by any on earth. Most of us rejoice at your awful crying. We live to force you to regret your own birth. Sky falls, ground is gone. Our Lord is uplifting. Your word has dissolved. The balance of love shifting. No way to lose, there is no way to lose. Can't lose your way when there is no way. We'll reify what had been your home, and all of your power becomes ours today. Thank you. sky falls, ground is gone. Our Lord is uplifting. Your word has dissolved. The balance of love is shifting.
Oh, I'm not that familiar with the story. I just know the main elements, of course, of Oedipus.
Yeah, Antigone's whole thing is she wants to bury her brother. They're both, you know, they're both basically without a family. Oedipus is their father brother, but he's exiled. You know, they're in this really difficult position. The brother dies. All Antigone wants to do is do what's right, and she ends up having to kill herself.
Right.
Antigone's brother rebelled against Creon, who took over after Oedipus exiled himself, after the big reveal in that story. Rebelled against Creon, his side lost, Creon's side won, the brother's killed. Antigone wants to bury the brother wants to use a ritual to bury the brother, which is the way, you know, people are typically buried. But because he was a rebel, Creon is not allowing it. He wants him buried essentially in unhallowed ground, the equivalent of unhallowed ground. Well, Antigone, and in fact orders the guy's body left outside. Antigone goes over and under cover of night, performs essentially reduced versions of the burial rituals. They find out, and Creon sentences her to death for violating his law. A friend of hers begs for and intercedes successfully to get Creon to forgive her and let the guy be buried. Creon agrees to it. They only go find out to discover she's gone to a crypt and hung herself, and Antigone has. So another happy Greek story told. It's interesting when that the opening of the last episode, when Antigone and Ray are in bed together, and the true confessions come out there, their core pain, they're sharing their core pain with each other.
Yeah.
And Annie's talking about, she sees a tree, a rock, and a cave. I mean, that's sort of a reference to the original story and where Antigone dies. Because in a sense, they're all carrying around somebody dead. Everybody's got a dead body that they're carrying around with them. You know, Antigone's got this sort of a dead inner child after the abuse.
Right.
And then her realizations about herself, that it really wasn't a fully abusive situation. Ray's got the guy he murdered. Woodrow's got this secret self that he's trying to kill.
Frank's still trapped in the basement.
Yeah, Frank's still trapped in the basement. That was a really well done scene when he tells Jordan about that. I mean, that was just really well done.
Right. So psychologically, this is like the fragmentation of the psyche through trauma, right? And then these parts get disowned and pushed down into the unconscious, which is like the underworld, and then we can't actually fully live because we don't have access.
Yeah, I've got all these notebooks of notes on this season and last season, part of the prepping for this paper I'm giving. And, you know, at one point, you know, I write, who is in whose underworld? Because all of these people, you know, they have this underworld they're reigning over, and it's filled with all these, you know, present and past people. Yeah, it's very crowded places.
Which is what would draw them together, like if they've got their fragments are magnetized to each other, or they're sort of locked in the same corners of the underworld. That would,
yeah, I totally agree. Yeah,
the matching traumas. When you're talking about how people are controlled socially, the Pavlov's dog thing, that is very interesting to me, because I think that's little understood, like how groups and agencies and these shadowy forces, the powers that be, use an understanding of psychology and the understanding of the individual, their own patterns and their own obsessions and weaknesses and desires and all the rest of it, to put handles on them as individuals and control them. And when somebody's triggered, whether it's by being offered what they want or having what they most love taken away or being threatened in some basic way, but when somebody's triggered, then they can't, they're just reacting, you know, they can't act autonomously. And that's very similar to the whole sort of drama of the gods, isn't it? The looking down from Olympus at human foibles and then incarnating to intervene and interfere in human affairs to stir things up. It's quite a similar.
And it's interesting, you know, in your draft you talk about walking corpses, you know, and poisoned people and things, and everybody's taken a sip of the poison in this. There's no, like Jordan says in the first episode, everybody gets touched. Everybody is somehow touched by the corruption that goes on, and nobody is completely innocent.
Right.
And the fragmenting of the self means that there is no way to regain innocence. And I'm not really sure that innocence can ever be regained. It's very popular to believe that in America, but I don't think it actually can be regained. And I think the Pizzolatto is referring to that as well in all of this. The you know, the whole interesting idea about how these figures, what is immortality in this? I mean, everybody in there wants immortality, but they don't want to live forever. They want money instead of immortality. It's like money is now the currency of immortality. It's not just transactional anymore.
Yeah. Well, money and children now, because you need someone
to
pass
it. Yeah, money and children. If you can't have one, have the other. That it's, well, and children are transactional. So in a way, children become a form of currency. The two, you know, the two get linked together.
Yeah.
Which is kind of an interesting, I mean, in some ways it seems, of course, this is how this goes. This is how multi-generational wealth happens. But the way that it's addressed in this second season, I think is interesting. The way that he puts it together. And the way that he lays out how it operates if in this group of people is really interesting and engaging.
Yeah. I'd like to look at this example then you brought up earlier of Woodrow and how he's snared, like this trap's laid for him, with this woman who offers to give him a blowjob, and how that sets him up to do the bidding of these powers, and then how we see that Woodrow is kind of incorruptible. Not in the sense of being innocent, but of just not being interested in sex. And this relates to his confused sexuality, of course, and his need to take Viagra with women, his desire to be a regular straight guy, and his internal conflict, and his impotence, and how that seems to tie into a theme in the thing about how all the men are impotent in one way or another because they're not autonomous.
Right. It's like it doesn't matter how much money you have. You know, the real thing, the real sort of source of powers is generative. And money is only generative in the sense that it is a metaphor for other things. It in itself doesn't actually do anything. Only when it is in motion does it actually do anything. So yeah, the true source of power is the power to generate, to have children, and hopefully pass down the money with them. But yeah, Woodrow becomes this incredibly complex character. I know people, I didn't read a whole lot of blogs this season or last season. I find a lot of them just really irritating. But some people, They weren't buying the whole gay thing with Woodrow, and they weren't buying that part of the story. And I thought it was perfectly logical for this to be the issue with him. I was completely unsurprised by any of it. And I was a little mystified at his reluctance to admit it, but again, it seemed like a really personal thing for him. He did not personally want to admit it, not that he had a lot of social fear about it. I think he just personally, like you're saying, didn't want to be that guy, and no matter what he did, it kept coming back. And this is kind of a Freudian idea, the idea of the eternal return, that what is in the id is going to keep coming up because the id always says yes. The id cannot and will not say no. It will always say yes. And, you know, there's no way that Woodrow is going to ever be able to get out from under this. And so it limits, so when he finds out that the girl is pregnant, I bought that. I think he was genuinely happy. I think he was relieved, probably more so than happy,
yeah,
because it gave him a sense of legitimacy.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes life is like that. Sometimes it's not necessarily all happiness. Sometimes you're just relieved at the way things work out, and you later derive happiness from that. And that's okay. That's part of maturity.
Didn't that seem doomed, though, also? I mean, even if he wasn't personally doomed by getting pulled into those plots, his attempt to actually be the guy he wanted to be and be a father and a husband, that seemed like wishful thinking, didn't it?
Yeah, and he's the one with the most overt death wish. I mean, first episode, he's going, he hits 100 miles an hour,
Right.
curves on a mountain, and then turns off his headlamp. I mean, this is the guy who really does want to die. As much as Belcaro may wake up every morning thinking, "Oh God, I wish I was dead," and Annie may wake up thinking, "Why isn't this over with?" Woodrow's the one with the plan. He's the one who goes in with the plan. So in some sense, it makes sense that he's the one who also, at midway the point ends up with a child, and then later we have the other one.
Well, you were talking about innocence a minute ago and how you don't think it's possible to get it back. And I mean, I would maybe add the thought that is it desirable to get it back
I don't think so.
either? And that this whole American dream of the child within and regained innocence and all that, isn't that very closely connected to the Puer Eternis and the Peter Pan myth, which is essentially the man who never grows up, who never really becomes a man?
Yeah, sure is. It's also related to early American literature dealt a lot with this idea of the New Eden, and that this was going to be a place where everything was going to be different, except that we brought ourselves with us. Of course, it was never going to be different because humans were here.
Yeah.
Never mind the humans that were already here, waging near constant war on each other. But yeah, everybody thought everything was going to be different. There's all kinds of literature, and it even extends up through Thoreau, who sees Walden as his Eve, and America as an Eden. It's this persistent idea that if nobody's looking, we can sort of act like things are different. And I think I'm hoping that, next 10 or 20 years we start seeing a shift away from that. But it is so persistent, and it's really valuable to advertisers too.
Right.
People sell a lot of diet food based on this whole idea of New Year, New You in January, which is just a very specific edition of that idea.
Yeah, and the idea of being locked in the past, really. If you're trying to get back to something that you think you've lost, then there's no way to go forward to what actually is there in front of you. So this would relate to those fragments again, I think, that if there's something has happened to us as children whereby our innocence was actually torn from us rather than organically grew into experience, then we're constantly divided and trying to get back to that, because we're unable to actually be adults.
Agreed. And it's interesting that that's the difference between Annie and Ray and Paul, and to a certain extent Frank. That's the difference between them. They had their childhoods torn away from them. Tony Chisani had everything handed to him, and his outcomes are completely different. The children of the wealthy and powerful will never have their childhoods wrenched away from them. I mean, even if there were abuse to that extent, they have enough of a safety net, enough just of a different environment that couldn't really happen to them. So it's like Pizzolatto is saying that the combination of these things, internal and external forces, pretty much doom you from the start. If you get these boxes ticked on your page, you're pretty much in it. This is it for you. Everything is over, at age, what, 11 or something like that.
So yeah, most people would not want to receive that message, and would see it as entirely negative, as a downer. But my experience of True Detective and of anything that really attempts to get to the core pain, as you put it, and succeeds, is that it is redemptive, it is transformative. Just the act of seeing this seemingly inescapable trap of repeating trauma that we're in, somehow that's what releases the trap. I mean, potentially, I don't say that it's really fully happened for me, but incrementally, that is my experience, that being willing and able to go into that feeling of absolute powerlessness allows me to let go of the need for power, And that is in itself liberating, because there isn't a need to be powerful, essentially. I mean, what you're talking about, the kind of power that these men are seeking, and the women, is not legitimate. It's never legitimate, is it, if it's an external kind of power?
Right, I agree. It's interesting that to go through that kind of pain and acceptance of the pain and acceptance of outcomes that you're talking about, you know, when you're younger, it's one of the things that helps you become mature. And when you are older and have a degree of maturity, that maturity helps you accept those things. So the two things end up actually working together over the course of your life. Pain gets easier to deal with as you get older because you've dealt with pain.
Hmm.
These guys, Tony Chisani, that generation of characters, they don't ever have to deal with that kind of pain. But A, because it probably won't happen to them, and B, even if they do, they've got so many things that they can use to diffuse the pain, they don't really ever have to face it. So, you know, that is maturity sufficient as a reward? You know, for some people it has to be, because that's all they have. You know, for people like Annie and Ray and Frank and Paul, that's all they've got. They're not going to have any other kind of rewards. They're not going to see any other benefit to their actions other than sort of personal growth.
Hmm. Well, I think that autonomy only comes about through maturity. Maturity and maturation only comes about through disillusionment and accepting defeat, would be my little, perhaps too tidy model, but you know, my experience so far. And that what the appeal of the characters in True Detective, particularly Ray, is just how utterly defeated he is, that somehow that gives him a kind of at least the beginnings of integrity, just his willingness to see and acknowledge the state that he's in.
I quite agree, and so many props to Colin Farrell for the way he pulled that character off. I mean, I was a little worried with him having one of the characters. Though he's had strong work in the past, I was a little worried, but by the end of the first episode, I knew it was going to be okay. He just did an amazing job with that, in showing this guy who was broken, and showing all the pieces of his breaking that he's carrying around with him all the time. You know, he's like a broken dish that carries itself around. You see all, and he is so far gone that he doesn't even bother to care if he's hiding it or if anybody sees it, like you're saying.
Yeah.
He's not open about it, but he doesn't care about the display of it either. And I don't think it's because he sees it as a source of strength. I think this is all he can do.
Yeah.
This is as much as he can hold himself together, sort of carry himself around in a little basket and just not drop anything, which is an extremely difficult place to be in. But given what he's doing, you know, the multiple drugs and all that stuff, not really a surprise.
Hmm.
But it's interesting, one of the points, and I don't know if this was deliberate on Pizzolatto's part, but one of the points where there was kind of a dip in action is where Ray shaves his beard. Yeah. And the first thing I thought of was Samson and Delilah.
Yeah, that's where, fair. Because I had the same thing, yeah. It's so weird.
Yeah, and I mean, Pizzolatto is so deliberate and so careful and so involved in details. I can't, of course it's not accidental. I mean, facial hair is too easy to do. It's not accidental, but, you know, is this really, there's this whole thing in detective fiction about cops being less competent than detectives or gumshoes or the gentleman investigator or somebody who is not a cop. Cops being less effective because they are so constrained by rules and they have a certain way of investigating and they never escape. They never step out of that way of seeing the world. And what happens is this caesura that occurs where Ray shaves his beard, this is where the cop stuff starts coming in. And this is where people start functioning under more traditional auspices of police procedurals.
Yeah.
And then he starts growing it back immediately and things go to hell.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's really kind of an interesting sign throughout this.
Yeah, but when things go back to hell for Ray, then the show redeems itself. So there's a kind of symmetry there.
The necessity of sacrifice. The end of it, that not only do we have to sacrifice, not only do people have to die, you know, people's lives have to be torn to pieces. I mean, things really have to be destroyed in ways that are impossible to gain any footing on getting back away from.
And I mean, the question of why, of course, is far deep for a TV show or a podcast, but in terms of why the TV show had to go there, I would say it's because that's that line in the play, that's what happens. I mean, it to represent reality at least a little bit, you know, I would say quite radically more than your average TV show, then it needed to continue the journey into the underworld. And it seemed as though the Ray shaving his moustache and cleaning up, and he even started wearing, you know, this funky cowboy gear and stuff, that was his attempt to clean up, and so that would signal that he's got this hope. He's regained hope, maybe after the showdown of episode 4, even though they didn't get glory for it. They did have the experience of being cops, being in a gunfight, of killing the bad guys. And the viewer has the same experience. Oh my God, it's turning into Heat, you know, it's turning into this great action show. That gives the viewer hope as well. But that hope is a false hope. It's not that kind of TV show. And Ray and the other characters aren't ever, they're not, they haven't emerged from the underworld. They've just had this momentary blip of dissociation in which they believe that maybe that's a light at the end of the tunnel rather than a hallucination or a mirage that's been created to lure them deeper in.
There's an interesting thing going on with names in it. The guy Lido Amarillo has a mixed Italian and Spanish name. The Spanish keeps coming up, and I think this is done really subtly on Pizzolano's part. Spanish keeps coming up all the way through it, kind of partly because of where they are, but I think partly too as a foreshadowing device. The name of the club where Frank eventually takes over is Luz Infinita, which is part Spanish and part Latin. So we keep getting these sort of pop-ups of this language stuff that keeps coming up. I think it's really interesting. And what first ticked me off, or first tipped me off, was Alida Amarillo's name, because I was like, this is a really kind of, clearly this is a street name, but, you know, why would you have something like, if you have a character, why would you pick that for your name? It's Yellow Casino, which is the color of Vince's casino, Vinci Gardens. You know, it's just, I don't know, maybe it may not mean anything. This season had less of a temptation to do the whole Lost thing where you go in and you examine every single detail. I mean, that was all about season one, you know, people trying to sort out
right. What
does this mean and what's the significance of this and everything.
Yeah.
Less so in this season. But yeah, there's a little stuff with names going on. I think Pizzolatto likes to have the occasional character name that is pronounced differently from the way that it looks on paper. I think that may just be a thing with him. I've never been able to figure out any significance to it. But after this season, I'm just going to come to expect it in his work.
Well, I imagine that he was at least somewhat aware of, obviously aware of the buzz around season one, but even the kind of obsessive attention it was getting that you're describing, and there's an overlap there then with what he did with season one and the audience for season one with the conspiracy culture, which is growing via the internet like so many other audience cults, but also growing in reality. I mean, as saying in UK 10 years ago, stuff that's on the daily news and on the papers every day was considered wacko conspiracy theories. So it's pretty hard to really to say, you know, what's a cultural phenomenon and what's merely a historical phenomenon, but certainly this obsessive attention to details and clues and symbolism and all the rest of it has been growing via the internet, relating as part of the conspiracy culture, subculture. There's a whole thing of synchromysticism, which isn't necessarily conspiratorial, but it's definitely about hidden clues in media. The whole thing around Kubrick recently, or growing with The Shining. And that's really interesting because season one particularly is about detectives on a trail of clues to uncover a mystery, but you could also say that what Pizzolatto is doing is he's trying to map his own mystery. Certainly in season two, that was what I ended up with, was that he's really trying to explore and represent in some way his own interiority, which is what an artist does. But then you can also extend this now to the audience, that the audience becomes detectives. They're trying to fathom what it is that the characters are trying to fathom, but also what it is that the show is trying to do. And, you know, is it authentic? Is it genuinely trying to uncover these mysteries, or is it part of the concealment? There's this whole kind of many-layered mystery, and all these different, you know, everybody becomes an investigator at that level of immersion.
Right, and it's really, really interesting because one of the dominant tropes of detective fiction is revelation and concealment, of course. And this gets played out in all different kinds of ways in the first season. And this dynamic between the investigator and the cop is an interrogation, this whole idea of interrogation. You know, we see almost no interrogations in the second season. That's a stock unit of police procedurals. It is a stock unit of cop stories and investigator stories and all that stuff. We see almost the only people really who get interrogated are the cops, are the main characters. They're the ones who are brought in for questioning. You know, they're the ones. Annie is the one who has to go to sexual harassment awareness and sensitivity training. You know, they're the ones who consistently get in trouble and who consistently are treated like criminals. So yeah, you have this inversion, and I think it's the audience involvement. I think people were expecting that similar kind of problem solving, fair play. Are they giving us fair play? Because that's an important part of detective fiction, written detective fiction anyways, is that the author has to provide the opportunity for the reader to at least have a chance of solving it themselves. And because readers get really angry when you don't do that. But that was never going to be an issue in the second season. And I got to believe that people went in thinking this was going to be able to happen. And no way. No way. This was a different setup. So yeah, you know, in the first season, viewers become investigators. They have this investment in what is going to happen and catching the bad guy and who the outcome is, being able to predict that. Yeah, season two, it is not possible. That interaction is not possible because the structure is so different. And that's part of the big message, I think, Pizzolatto wants us to hear, is there is a structure here that you cannot participate in. You will never have access to. It is moving behind the scenes. There are things you're going to have real difficulty discovering. And if you do discover them and talk about them, you're going to be called a crackpot. You know, and this is how this works. And here it is. Here's how it goes.
Were you aware of the comments about the weird parallels with Mad Men and the last episode of Mad Men taking place at Esalen, or Esalen stand-in, and then the first episode of True Detective also going to this spiritual retreat that resembled Esalen?
I was not a big Mad Men watcher. I watched the first couple of seasons. Tell me more about that, because I did like what I saw of Mad Men. I liked very, very much. Similar to this in that Pizzolatto is not afraid of silence, which I very much approve. The same thing in Mad Men. You know, there were these places where there were these long, uncomfortable silences, and I thought it worked perfectly. So yeah, tell me what you think about that.
Well, I won't go into the whole thing about Mad Men, except to say that I did watch all the episodes and I loved it, and it held up to the end. And by the end, and somewhat before the end, I say realized, and it's kind of obvious, but I came upon the sort of capsule description of it as a soap opera about social engineering. And the sort of paradoxical nature of that, because of course soap operas are part of social engineering. They're completely 100% escapism, and they don't represent reality. Whereas social engineering is a layer of reality that actually generates the reality that we take as for granted as the way society works, but it really conceals what's going on under the surface. And Mad Men played this very interesting game in that way, in that it was just hinting at stuff throughout. It never explicitly referred to Edward Bernays or the really sort of overt psychological concepts of advertising and how it manipulates perception and all the rest of it. But of course, it was about advertising. And then by the end, there's this, or at the end in the final episode, Don Draper ends up, he's lost. I mean, he's lost throughout the whole season, the whole show. 7 seasons or whatever it is, he never really becomes found. But he does end up at this spiritual retreat that resembles Esalen, and he has this epiphany where he recognizes himself as a commodity, not just a seller of commodities, but actually a commodity himself. So it's a kind of does overlap with this mysterious subtext of True Detective, the second season, which I kind of intuited about how human beings become transporters of goods in some way, transporters of cultural values. That whole idea is also in Mad Men. And at the end, he has this epiphany, and it seems like maybe it's a good thing. Maybe Don Draper has found his way, and he'll never go back to the world of advertising. But then the last sequence is the Coke ad, the famous Coke ad about "I'd like to teach the world to sing," whatever it is, with all the world holding hands. And we're meant to infer from that that Don Draper went back to the world of advertising with this new spiritual quote-unquote awareness, and that infused advertising with a new kind of depth and subtlety and way to actually colonize people's consciousness using spiritual methods to do so. So that's social engineering. That's a maybe not in a nutshell, but a very significant aspect of social engineering, that it uses not just psychological, but what we might think of as spiritual disciplines to manipulate people's perception on a mass scale. And that is referred to throughout True Detective Season 2. Like, there's all these hints and more than hints, which, as I said, they never really come together, but at the same time, they're too overt and too multiple to be ignored. I mean, like the psychologist reading Castaneda and taking notes. I mean, that seemed really arbitrary, but it's so striking that it can hardly be arbitrary, particularly as you're pointing out that nothing seems to be arbitrary in Pizzolatto's schemata.
Well, not when the title of the book is a separate reality. I
Right.
mean.
And also, there's Castaneda turns into a crow, so there's that reference.
I'm not familiar with Castaneda. I've had friends who were deeply into it, but I haven't made it to Castaneda yet. But yeah, I mean, that totally makes sense. Have you read Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson?
I just read that.
Okay, so you know about weaponized memes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is essentially what we have, and this is, I'm going to refer to this obliquely in my paper next week about season one. The original book, The King in Yellow by Robert Chambers, published in 1895, there's a text within a text called The King in Yellow. And it is this book that drives people insane. Or it's a play, drives people insane. It's been banned in multiple countries. In France, they tried to find all the copies and burn them, that kind of thing. It's a weaponized
This
meme.
is a real thing, not a story about a thing.
The Chambers book is real. The text within the Chambers book, the Chambers book is also called The King in Yellow, very confusing, but the text that Chambers talks about in that work is fictional. People have tried to come up with a version of it, like Lynn Carter wrote a version of it, I want to say in the 80s. Yeah. It's okay, but it's not going to get banned in Boston, much less Paris.
Right, it's like the Monty Python skit about the joke that was so funny that it was least.
Oh, that's right. That's right, I forgot about that. But yeah, so yeah, it's a weaponized meme, and that gets carried into season one, right, when you have this book called The King in Yellow that is being given to all these people, and this girl, Dora Lange, that first victim that they found, starts writing about it in her diary and starts quoting passages from it. It's the idea that there's a thing that can go from person to person, this idea that can go in and destroy people's lives. And you know, the interesting thing about season two is, that's a lot of maybe saying, it's this idea of the American dream that is in fact a weaponized meme.
Right.
I mean, this is what happens when people try to, people, you know, who don't have the right kind of access, try to fulfill the American dream for themselves. That in some way, parts of them have to be destroyed, whether it's, you know, their dreams of youth, you know, of, you know, being rich and famous or whatever, the dreams of having children, the dreams of being a multi-generationally wealthy family, whatever. These ideas destroy people. And here, in this particular situation, here are the ideas, and here's who's dying.
Hard water down your throat, down your back. Hard to say it's hard luck when you're so happy.
The second part of this conversation will be up at the same location on Wednesday the 19th of August. Heather's blog is notesonhplovecraft.blogspot.com. To support this podcast, go to horticulture.com, any page, and click donate in the right-hand margin. To join the discussion, register at kubicon.com/maze, or go to the community menu link at the top of horticulture.com website. There is an accompanying article to this podcast, which you will find posted at the blog horticulture.wordpress.com. I will also be linking to an audio file of a reading of said article. Thanks for listening. Be sure and tune in next week.
Wallet full of fat, belly full of milk. You're touchingly, deeply fulfilled. You're very old, you're very new. You're touchingly, deeply confused. Can't you see it's a way out, men are you don't.